So the Health in Prisons Project of the World Health Organization has not paid me anything to put on this uniform as a cheerleader for them. I did it voluntarily because I've been banging my head up against the brick walls of U.S. prisons for about 40 years doing rights and advocacy work for prisoners and visiting many prisons in the U.S. And, you know, it's been very gratifying work, yet also very discouraging work, as we'll go through some of the details of that. And so you can imagine how I love to hang out with people like Jose and these characters. They're a balm for me. They're an inspiration for me. And I think that and I think they should be an inspiration for all of us in terms of what the U.S. needs. So I won't belabor these points, but it is true that during the past 30 years, the U.S. has entered a period of what we can call, and APHA has called, mass incarceration. We have very high incarceration rates, skyrocketing to what you see there. 50%, of course, are locked up for nonviolent offenses. I just want to say and point out that racial and financial biases play a significant role in determining who actually becomes incarcerated. I'll give you one example. African Americans are 15% of the illicit drug users in the U.S. They comprise 37% of those arrested for drug use, and 59% of those convicted, and 74% of those sentenced to prison. So at every step along the way in the criminal prosecution and detention system, there's that kind of racial bias in the U.S., and it's not only in drug use. Black Americans have this astounding incarceration rate of over 4,630 per 100,000, and they're half of the prisoners in the U.S. despite being only 12% of the population. Black man has a better chance going to prison than to college, and this is a big industry. $40 billion a year is spent on it. In 1980, the U.S. spent 28 cents on prisons for every dollar spent on higher education. That figure is now 60 cents. We are truly a nation that loves prisons, and in a categorization by the Center for Prison Studies in the UK, we are the only nation in that category. No other nation has that pride. I would assert to you as well that prisons do more harm than good. While there are more than 2.3 million behind bars in the US, we're not a safer country for it. In fact, the rates of all index crimes are either the same or a little bit worse than when this anti-crime, so-called anti-crime effort began in the 1960s. Even the state of purpose of prisons has changed in the U.S. over these past 40 years. It's gone from the rehabilitation model to now what is called first containment and now incapacitation. And that has a variety of meanings, which we can discuss at another time. What about our recidivism rates? Well, more than half of the prisoners nationwide go back to prison within a few years. That's really unlike any place else in the world. And my state of California, we're up to 66%. So we're very proud of that. And increasingly, people get out of prison and return to communities that are more impoverished than they were in the decades before. So that the incidence of severe poverty has increased 26% more than the overall growth of poverty since 1975. So that makes it even less likely that folks getting out will have access to the kinds of good services and opportunities that are available to keep them out. Illiteracy is a great problem in the U.S. population, as we've seen in the political campaigns recently, but particularly in prisons where 19% of the prisoners are illiterate and up to 60% functionally illiterate, yet that's not even tackled. But once in prison, the harm continues in as regards prisoners' health. Prisoners bring to prison, as was described, a concentration of health problems secondary to poverty, drug use and trauma, with high rates of the illnesses that you see there. And despite decades of legal action by prisoners and human rights advocates, governments really haven't allocated adequate money and haven't organized coherent services to care for the prisoners' real needs. Also, of course, the penal medical providers often adopt custodial attitudes, which doesn't help very much because they don't retain the independence required to carry out decent healthcare. If we have time at the end or afterwards, I'd love to tell you about Valley Fever epidemic in California and how prisons are a main contributor to the high rates and increasing rates of coccidiomycosis infection in California. But the Department of Corrections is praying for a vaccine rather than making any decent policy choices. Of course, the rates of HIV are 5 times the general population, and seroconversion has been found wherever it's been looked at, which is very few places, within prisons. Hep C is 100 times more infective than HIV, as you're aware, and prisoners are a profound reservoir of Hep C, the Hep C-infected U.S. population, with more than a third of those infected being behind bars on any given day. Yet little education and treatment is carried out in prison. And what we've heard from Jose, harm reduction inside is absolutely unknown. There is not a single facility in the United States prison system that does opiate substitution therapy for prisoners, except for withdrawal or in a few classes of prisoners, perhaps a few days before they get out. Only 18 of 50 prisons have any peer education program, and those peer education programs are hamstrung because, of course, they cannot deal with harm reduction, because needle possession, drug use, sex are all illegal in prison and punished. Mental health is, of course, another issue, and you don't do very well with overcrowded prisons like this. This is a typical prison, level 3 prison in California. That's a gym that's been converted to a housing unit. We've been in a state of emergency in California for 3 years, declared by the governor and the legislature, yet they have not figured out among them, including the courts, how to get a single prisoner out. Not one prisoner has been released in 3 years during a state of emergency of overcrowding. More than 16% of our prisoners do have serious psychological and psychiatric disorders, and the prison could play an important role in raising the mental health of this population and therefore the poor and communities of color from which the prisoners come and to which they return. I would say to you that my favorite latest book is one called The Warehouse Prison by Dr. John Irwin. The Warehouse Prison, read it. It really is a wonderful social anthropological study of a medium security prison in California. And John just goes in there, finds out what's happening, and then tells us what the prisoners are saying about their lives. And this is the one, these are the kinds of things they're saying, is that by being in prison, in these warehouse prisons, prisoners actually come worse off than when they went in for these long sentences under these adverse conditions. They develop difficulty in acting independently on their own behalf, with diminished sense of self, changes in their sexual orientation, anger and injustice, of course, and misery and adoption of this outsider kind of criminal mentality as a defense mechanism against the brutalization in which they have to endure. Economic exploitation, when you have an industry this big, comes along with it, particularly in the U.S. Prisoners really begin to understand and express quite freely that they are cogs in this prison industrial complex. They understand that they're $40,000 per year raw material. Yeah, they have a use, they're raw material, for this $40 billion a year industry, for all of the various purveyors of construction companies, architects, custodians, teachers, you know, everyone who makes money. My worst glaring example of that is the phone fees. They are charged exorbitant fees to make phone calls out of the prisons in California and in most states, not all, but in most, and a slice of that profit, huge profit, goes back to the state, usually to the general revenue fund. So that basically means that grandma who picks up the phone from her grandson in prison is paying a poor tax to our state to go to the general fund. Thank you very much. But there are, even in the U.S., with all our troubles, various NGOs and organizations that oversee or relate to the incarcerated population. Of course, the government directly controls the prosecution and detention system, and it's been a regressive policy force with longer sentences and all kinds of laws, and you know that. The largest and most influential U.S. NGO is the American Correctional Association. It's 57 years old and offers educational programs for prison industry professionals and certifies members, and it accredits penal facilities. It's actually supported by the fees from those it accredits and from prison industry concerns. So the large corporations like Correctional Corporation of America, the GEO Group, which was Wackenhut, Correctional Services Corp, the various medical corporations, these industry giants, they support the ACA through their conferences. And the ACA espouses very good principles. Rights for all, integrity, fairness, go to their website, they sound wonderful. But in fact, their accreditation process, if you look at it carefully, allows their auditors to waive compliance with standards. And the standards leadership, those who do the actual accreditation, have been dominated by quite controversial former prison officials. And they see the importance of mass incarceration. It's money to them. So they don't want to depopulate the prisons. They definitely want to keep it all going, partially in response to the failures of the ACA in an effort to focus attention on the dismal medical services in our facilities. The National Commission on Correctional Healthcare was formed in the 1970s by the American Medical Association. And there have been prison litigation by the ACLU, and various judgments have been won. The NCCHC certifies individuals also, and also penal medical programs. And it plays a better role because it's very focused, but on the other hand, it too depends for its financial survival on the very people that it accredits. So that makes it, I think, difficult for them to play a firmly and independent role. So that's why I think that we need something like the Health in Prison Project in the U.S. There really is no truly independent body outside of government or business that functions in the U.S. And the politicians are hopeless, really. They refuse to do anything. They won't let anyone out. They're afraid to say anything that to be seen as soft on crime. And primarily, and this is where I argue with them, they refuse to do any public education. I mean, I keep on saying to my own assembly representative on our public safety committee, Fiona, please, you can have the ear of the population. You could go up and down this state and teach people about crime and punishment, the realities of it. She won't do it. None of them will do it. They won't take the time to do it. They don't see it as a priority. I don't want to say that there, I don't want you to get the impression I believe that there are not wonderful people working in prison. There are. There are many who work in jails and prisons for the best interest of their patients and society, dedicated public health people and medical practitioners, and they need effective support, and quality people must be recruited and retained. But with its stated goals, and this is where I like the Health in Prison Project of the World Health Organization, of which Spain is a part, many other nations in Europe, with its stated goals of supporting member states in improving public health, by addressing health and health care in prisons and facilitating the links between prison health and public health systems at a national and international level, a WHO-style Health in Prison Project would really help us. I mean, surely the U.S. penal systems need help in developing objectives and strategies that are the core of HIP's purpose, the promotion of cooperation and integration of best practices and public health into prison medicine can help reverse how the U.S. prisons presently increase health inequalities. HIP, the Health in Prison Project, focuses on drug addiction, infectious disease, and mental health using a human rights context, a context almost unknown in our penal facilities, and could help break the logjam of prejudice and inaction that now exists. You've seen what happens in Spain and the harm reduction strategies that are ordinary there. We really need that, of course. And partnerships between government and NGOs can broaden the debate and allow for the development of policy and program that avoid the narrowness and superficial reactivity of political expedience and election campaigning posturing that has driven the U.S. to its present state of dysfunction. HIP is organized through the World Health Organization. We are, the U.S., as a member of the Pan-American Health Organization, and perhaps PAHO can be interested in developing a HIP-style program. We would certainly welcome that. The successes of WHO HIP and the lessons learned about how to fashion a coherent and useful network would be a meaningful contribution to U.S. Penal health reform. Thank you very much.
Stay there, Corey. Right, any comments or questions for Corey?